wanted to speak with you tonight on the theme Beyond the Teaching of Becoming. As rootedness in witnessing opens, it's discovered that it's natural to observe and to fully experience all of life's unfolding events. You've been hearing the word witnessing a fair amount since last night. And sometimes the mind can get a sense that witnessing is a sort of detached, distant, back there, kind of cold quality. Nothing could be more false about that. Witnessing is also fully participating. Fully participating and yet deeply watching simultaneously. Some of us enjoy being spectators. We enjoy entertainment of different kinds. We like to spectate on the sport or the music, the movie, and so forth. But is it not possibly true that you don't really enjoy being a spectator unless you have your realm of deep participation? That doesn't mean you have to have an audience, but that to just spectate, to be entertained as a spectator without having also participated in life, maybe along with the spectating, as a full participant, something would be hollow, wouldn't you say? I love the game of soccer. I've been playing it since I was a boy, and recently in the last 5 years had a chance to coach my son, and it will wind up probably our last season this coming year. We'll see. It's a beautiful game. Not just to the Brazilians. The Brazilians call it the beautiful game. But it's a beautiful game. And the opportunity a couple months ago to just watch the college team where my daughter's attending college play a soccer game. And it was one of those days that you wanted to kind of just freeze frame it, because it was absolutely perfect ambience, not just for soccer. It came down to the last play of the game, scores 1-1. It's been a really good game, fair game, good game, exciting game. Last play of the game, home team gets a corner kick, which is where you kick it in from the corner, bring it in front of the goal if you can. Guys there just on the right spot, heads the ball in, game's over. Couldn't ask for anything better in the way in terms of the ending of the game, especially since I was on the home team. I'm spectating for the home team. And it all just happens so fast, and sometimes the mind wants the replay, doesn't it? Almost rather watch it on TV, because then you can get the replay. This particular mind wanted a replay of some of the qualities of feeling that came out of doing the movement this afternoon with those who moved in the room with Steve guiding us. That energy right there, wanting to do the replay, that's called grasping. And the Buddhist teachings would say that's suffering. It might not just be the Buddhist teachings, it might be the truth as you see it. Because what really matters isn't what anybody else sees, it's not what anybody else says, It's not how anybody else puts it together. It's how do you see it? How do you put it together? As this observing opens up, and it includes more and more of what arises without distortion, without prejudice. And if distortion or prejudice is arising, then there's an opportunity to see that, to learn from that. Participation in means deepening into this bodily and feeling connection. Connection into things as they are. And this opens glimpses into the realization that not only are you participating in everything that's happening, eventually it becomes clear you actually are everything that's happening. Everything is arising in presence. Presence isn't just watching. Everything is presence, or everything is being. And being is emptiness and form. Nothing and everything simultaneously. So the easiest way to have a sense of that is when you, so to speak, go into the deep sleep state, this is nothingness. And then nothingness wakes up in the morning, sometimes with the ringing of the bell, which you might note was changed this morning from 5:30 to 6. And it will be changed again for those of you who are need that, to 6. Because sometimes we like being in the nothingness longer. Rather than being in the nothingness, we like being the nothingness longer. And then the everything wakes up. Okay, this is the everything. And you don't have to get sort of metaphysical about it and kind of go off into some cosmic everythingness and start imagining, you know, da-la-la-la-la. Just take this. This is the everything, and it's unfolding and changing. And everything is beingness unfolding. Nothing is beingness unfolding. Okay, so I'm going to try to do something now that I hope will frame some very, I hope, significant and important points. Rather views, okay? See how this goes. You never know how these talks are going to go, you know? The worst thing in the world is when you're giving one of these talks and it's going flat, you know, or you're getting a flat tire and you can kind of feel it coming. You got that feeling? And before it starts going long, 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 you can kind of feel something starting to happen up in that front left, front right, back left. I went on a retreat once up in Edmonton, Alberta, and every windshield on every car I saw was cracked. Some of them cracked all the way from the right side to the left. And I inquired about this, and I was informed, oh, all the windshields are cracked around here. When it's 40 below, things crack. You got to heat the car up and all this stuff. So I'm riding with this guy, and I was asking him about that kind of in the back axle. He said, well, that's just one of the things also that happens to the cars up here, because sometimes you come out and your tires are so frozen, you start driving and the whole thing's going clunk, 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 and you just floor it at that point and hope it works. And this is in the middle of the summer, it was 60 degrees, and he still had to clunk, clunk, clunk. So there was one very, very beautiful moment where this retired monk, this German monk, I was talking about him in one of the groups today, 25 years he was a monk in Thailand and India, Burma, all that, you know, the rounds. Really serious German dude. Anyways, he's meditating, and the story I want to tell you now is that it was years after he'd kind of done all that, and he was back in the non-robe experience called, you know, the clothes, and he was giving this talk, and it was definitely flat. I mean, it was definitely going off bad, and you know, here's this 25-year, you know, quarter of a century experienced you know, student teacher of the Dharma, and the talk is just not working. And so he just admits it to everybody. This isn't working. I quit. Ask some questions. So people started asking questions, and it just lit up because there was such honesty. Just willingness. I had never seen anything like that. I was like, you can't do that. You're teaching. Get it together. What do you mean it's not working? Some of you that have spent probably too much time around me, you know that I like the quote from John Lennon. He said, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And he left us too soon. So here we go. There's at least three distinct and popular and compelling, very compelling views about why and how we are here right now. Okay? The why would address causation or origin or genesis, and the how would address effect or result, or you could say the process of what is actually happening in direct experience. Okay, so we have the why and the how. One view would say that destiny or karma has brought us to this moment, and there is nothing we could have done to change this happening. This view becomes even more interesting to some of us in that if we were to think we could redirect things and, let's say, just decide to get up and walk out of this here room, call it quits for the retreat, and even firmly believe or assume that we're directing this act of walking out of here, which means you get an F. You failed. Didn't stay through the class. If that happened, in fact, destiny, karma, would only be playing out yet another one of its many acts through that so-called decision to split. At the extreme, this view has humans as puppets on the string of karma, and those who are well off, comfortable, healthy, have good karma to thank for it, and those in pain, ill health, and unhappiness are fundamentally reaping the results of bad karma from wherever it might have originated. And sometimes the theory goes, this life, other lives as other beings. And even if you have bad karma, you're very lucky you're a human being. Because it isn't easy to be a human being. You could have been born a mutt, like my mutt dog, Bailey, half chow, half hound. One of the happiest beings I've ever met. Just proves you can be born a mutt and be happy. She could come on these, but she doesn't know how to sit still yet. So the best you can do then in this karmic destiny in charge model, if your karma is bad, is write it out. And a little bit more precisely, transform the karma. Work it out. Work your way into a better place. And only you can do that. Other people can't take your karma away. Although some of us would like that, wouldn't we? We'd like somebody to come along and just peel it off. Or when it really gets rough in the sitting hall, inside the body, just look around. You're not supposed to do this. Look around and look at somebody who's looking real composed and pretend you're them. It might work for a moment. So in terms of this transforming of karma, Because, you know, in a way, if you go with this view, you don't really need to transform your good karma. Just enjoy it. Sort of the eat, drink, and be merry mode, spiritually speaking. So what happens then is all kinds of methods and techniques and practices are given to help you accomplish the transformation of this karma. And this view would promote the notion that this potential, this destiny, this karma, is continuously unfolding even through the array of ideas and apparent choices we make based on our own or others' ideas, irregardless of how appropriate, supportive, or unappropriate, unsupportive, these ideas and actions from these ideas have on our well-being and happiness. Pretty far-reaching potential there, huh? Okay. View number one. By the way, you get to, at the end of this, there's going to be three of these, so you get to go. Door number one, door number two, door number three. Which one am I going through? Let's make a deal. An equally compelling view would have it that each of us has chosen to be here. We have chosen to be here, and we've selected this time, and that we could be doing any other thing that we can think of, or would like to do, or have the means to carry out. Of course, as you can see right now, this view means the so-called opposite of the previous view. In that if we say that we could just as easily have come here, then we could also say we could just as easily not have come here. And even if there's a force called destiny at work, that anywhere and at any time that we choose, we can interrupt this force and act according to our own free will. Provided, a little key here, provided, we have a clarity about what we're choosing to do and the will to carry it out. Does this sound popular? I don't need to go too far into politics now, do I? So in this view, if destiny exists, because it might not discard it, but if it exists and it's at work here, then the name of the game is to become master of one's own destiny. Master one's destiny. And this clearly means many different things to many different people. Runs the gamut. Having what you want in terms of a house, partner, children, grandchildren, work, type of people at the work, country you live in, food you eat, right up to, I want to get enlightened. And there's plenty of suggestion, I want to suggest that it's hypnotic suggestion, that if you do this, 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 and this correctly, you can get enlightened. And if you can't make that work, then it could be your karma. It could be that you're just unlucky, or that you're not enough like the person who's telling you you can do that. And sometimes, sadly enough, you haven't paid enough yet because it's going to cost you. You think a car costs a lot? You think a house costs a lot? You think something costs a lot? This is the biggest thing, so it's going to cost a lot. It's spiritual materialism. this view of master your own destiny clearly runs the gamut. A third, door number three, perhaps even more attractive and popular view, is some kind of combination of the first two. In other words, there is both destiny, karma, and there is also free will. The intersection of these two views, the braiding of these two views, is what forms the basis of much spiritual, religious ideology and teaching. Any teaching that's dualistic is in some way representing the intersection of these two views. And I might add that the intersection of these two views, free will and destiny karma, all operating together, forms much of the collective consciousness that's floating on planet Earth right now. Collective consciousness of humanity. What people actually believe is true. Destiny, fate is at work, and so countless things happen in life, and they happen to you or around you, to your loved ones, to ones you know or don't know, and no one saw it coming. No one could have predicted it. And sometimes in the tragic, which is one of the qualities of life, the human life, the tragic, when the tragic shows up, the archetype of the tragic, humans are shocked. And they even go into, why did it happen to me? Why has God forsaken me? I wouldn't want it to happen to anyone else, but why did it have to happen to me? Or the good fortune prevails, the metaphoric lotto win. And the mind often asks, to what extent can these events be influenced? If the tragic has struck, is there a way to organize life so it doesn't happen again? If the goodwill, the good fortune, the blessing has occurred, is there a way to increase it, to maximize it, to repeat it? So here's my question right here at this point for us. How does destiny or karma interrelate with duty? And I use the word duty right now in the sense of doing what you feel you must do. You know that feeling? Doing what you feel you must do, even sometimes when you truly don't want to do it. You have little or no interest in it, but you must do it. Wanted and unwanted, desirable and undesirable things keep happening, don't they? They've been happening today, they've been happening yesterday, they've been happening the day before, they've been happening every day. Just as the pleasant and unpleasant feelings keep happening every day. As this feeling life is open to as its witness, as the allowance of the pleasant and the unpleasant, is truly received, then naturally wanting and not wanting fades, desirable and undesirable fade. And people, not just me, stop calling the sensations in this part of the body headache. It's just sensation. It's no longer a headache. It's no longer even undesirable or unwanted. It's just energy. And as a bonus prize to that, often with that loosening, the so-called sensations of unpleasantness transform so much more easily because they're not resisted. You don't like what's happening at any level of experience? Throw some more unliking on that which you're not liking. It's like gas on the fire. It's physics, I guess. Sort of. So how does destiny or karma interrelate with what you must do or what you are doing or think you need to do or want to do? Good question? Not an easy question to answer? That's a good question. Sherlock Holmes said, "What good is a question? It gives an easy answer." Once the quest for true understanding is awakened, and some humans it's awakened early in childhood. Watching my 13-year-old son, and he handed me a book the other day, a novel. It's called Life as We Knew It. And he said, "Here, you might want to read this." And walked off. "You might want to read this." Now, something's already happening, which I'm deeply appreciating, just based on the title, Life as We Knew It. Don't let the teacher have too much fun, okay? That's a koan. If you think I'm having too much fun, you got to figure out how to send me a message. Calm down, Paul. As that awakening impulse arises, whenever, however, because it's unique, really, for all of us, and yet there's commonalities. We're so much more alike than we are different. And yet we are unique, each of us, not just in our fingerprint. That's why the cops fingerprint you. It's more important than the mugshot, because you can kind of morph the mugshot. It's real difficult to get a different fingerprint, although people even try that. It's unique. Once that awakening impulse arises, it becomes increasingly clear that what's unfolding moment to moment is based on, both based in something so mysterious and vast. And at the same time, when there's a dream occurring, a daydream, a night dream, that you are a separate individual, then you are compelled from that separateness to keep asking, to what extent are we co-creators in this mystery? Such that meaning in the immediate reality somehow gets clear. However that immediate reality is shaped, what's the meaning of it? That's the idea coming from the so-called separate individual who attempts to figure out how to be a co-creator in the mystery of it all. By the way, young children, don't bother with that. Yeah? They're in a consciousness that's prior to that kind of development. They're not concerned about being co-creators. They're not concerned with some notion of being separate. In the baby's experience, if you observe the baby, they're splashed into beingness. I was walking on the street in Ireland once and found myself at a stop sign. Cars are going, you know, and there's a light, stop sign for pedestrians, you know what I mean. And anyways, I'm standing there and there's a woman and she has three children. And one looked to be about 8 or 9. One looked to be about 4 or 5. And the other was in the stroller. And it lined up. It was perfect in a way. The littlest one was closest to me, with the mama behind, and then it stacked up. I looked in the mama's face and I saw what I imagined to be burdensomeness, weight. I looked in the 9-year-old's face and I saw a lesser weight, but still weighted. I looked in the 4 or 5-year-old's face and I saw a little bit of weighted, but less than the older one. I looked in the baby's face, there was no weightedness. It was just... What happened to that baby? In the teachings of becoming, which are dualistic teachings, which many of us have received in different forms, whether you went to church or not, it doesn't mean that non-dual truth can't pop through the so-called dualistic teaching or the dualistic sermon or the dualistic framework. But it is still a bit rare. In the teachings of becoming, a very big question is, to what extent are we capable of piloting this ship of life? And to what extent is the sea and its many changing tides in charge of what happens and how it happens, particularly in regards to awakening? Let me repeat that. That's kind of a real turning point here. In the teachings of becoming, dualistic teachings, born out of the idea that you are a separate individual and that if you work at this or do that, or if you're pious, if you're concentrated, if you're this, if you're that, sometimes, sadly enough, if you're male, then you can entertain, and you must entertain, the question, to what extent are you capable of piloting this ship of life, and to what extent is the tide of the sea in charge of what's happening and how it's happening? And so we turn now into an expression on planet Earth of potentially confusing suggestion or message that might sound paradoxical to a mind that's trying to figure it out, and that is in the world of Zen. In Zen it's said, enlightenment is an accident. Meditation makes you accident prone. Not bad, huh? The so-called personal or immediate reality is not just set within ultimate reality, but is intimately a part of it. That statement articulates a false dichotomy. Those among us who are entertaining ideas of the relative and ideas of the absolute and theories and practices and methods and so forth about the relative and the absolute are playing in concepts. Nothing wrong with it. If that's what you're interested in, have at it. Have you noticed how much it appears? If you can think about something, it appears you get to do it. Let's see if we can take that apart, though. Waking up from the dream of separation, the dream of isolation, the dream of separateness, reveals that the true nature of reality is actually unfolding continually in the very things one thought were not the true nature. Including the idea or dream of being a separate individual who is going to awaken or be free or enlightened. That is no less the true nature unfolding than anything else. In this context, then, afflictive states of mind or body, which is that stuff that gets the attention, I mentioned it last night, regardless of origin, will finally get proper care and attention, which is the kind, loving awareness that they've always deserved. And if that kind, loving awareness was there, maybe they never would have arose. That's another idea. But in awakening, it's discovered that these so-called conditions, afflictive states of body-mind, undesirable as they sometimes appear to be, irregardless of where they come from, they are part of the seamless fabric, the seamless tapestry, and they are not separate from anything else. And most key, they are not happening to anyone. Bless you. Why do we say that? Bless you. I was told once, I don't know whether I believe this, that the sneeze is a moment of potential enlightenment if you can be conscious in it. but you have to figure out how to, instead of going down, you have to kind of go up. Because what you really are is up, not down. I've been working on that a little bit to see if there's any validity to it. It sounds crazy. It's called the tradition of the sneeze. Okay, now, in these talks, there's usually one or two statements I feel personally that are the whole deal. Okay, so here's one, and there might be another one. The dream of separation is what makes for affliction, not specific feelings or state. The dream, the idea, the feeling that you are a separate individual is the root of affliction, not the feelings or states that arise and pass. What this understanding, experientially, of those words means is that care is liberated. Yeah, empathy is liberated. Compassion is liberated into this form. And it's liberated into relationships that this form has with other forms. And it's liberated into all parts of the natural world because it's seen, felt, experienced that all of it is me. One of my sisters got divorced not too long ago. It was very nasty, difficult, painful. I think it almost took her into the mental hospital. It certainly took her into medications, and some pretty heavy ones, too. So her name is Linda. I know her as Linda, my older red-haired sister Linda. In her prime, she used to hold me down and blow on my stomach for fun and dress me up like a girl for extra fun and then blow on my stomach as I was dressed up like a girl for triple fun. So she gets divorced and she almost ends up in the mental hospital and she's on heavy meds and she's going through therapy, and today, this is about 12, 13 years after the divorce is finalized, she can't talk about it. She did with her therapist, I guess. She can't talk about it. She goes, I don't want to talk about that. I asked once. It's called respect, I guess. Why push somebody? In the name of you think it's good for them, that's your deal, not theirs. Anyways, she changes her name. You know how people got to change their name sometimes? So she changes her name from Linda to Melinda. And it's Ma with an E. Me, Linda. Now, she does this many years ago, and it just doesn't register over here. And I'm calling her We Linda. W-E. We Linda, we Linda, we Linda. She lets it go on and on and on. And about 6 months ago, she writes an email. And she goes, the name is me. And she puts like, she like, does everything you can on the computer to like bold up the me. Do you get it? When I got divorced, I became more me. Wow. Okay, I think I got it. Okay, Melinda. Registered. Maybe we'll get to explore the me-we so-called dichotomy one day. You know, it's interesting that us human beings seem to be the only beings on planet Earth who have a self-separating consciousness. A couple months from now, a good friend of mine from California and another good friend from Arizona and another good friend from Florida, the four of us, the Four Stooges, are going to head down into Baja, California and hang out with the whales. And you know, sometimes things come up and you say yes. So my friend who's been there 12 times, I said to him, why should we go there? And he said to me, these whales are mahatmas, Paul. Mm-hmm. I said, you don't need to even finish the sentence, Tomas. I'll go. The dream of separation is the idea that you're a person who has afflictive states and we'll hopefully get out of them one day. This is embedded in the teachings of becoming. It's embedded in the consciousness of those who propagate, well-intended, I might add, teachings of becoming. You can become this if you do that. Or that, or stop doing that, or stop doing this. You can become this, this, this. Well intended. Gets many people's attention. Things can be better for you. And the human being is naturally adapted for contemplation, for reflection. Inherent in our awakening nature is to be curious and to wonder and to meditate. And meditation opens up virtue. It opens up the good, as Socrates said. The good. And this good basically means caring towards and about all things. And this caring becomes free and spontaneous. It's an absence of an ethos of love and compassion on planet Earth or whatever else is out there that blocks the human from seeing the reality of kinship and community. Not only with each other, but with all things. Because in that absence of the ethos of love and compassion, the human has missed the common bond of vulnerability and transiency that we all share. And so in meditation, some of us have heard, I certainly have heard, in order to practice meditation, you have to have a certain base in virtue first. You have to get your act together ethically, your right livelihood, your right speech, your right action. You need to get these things settled and balanced and steady and conscious. And only then can you meditate. And it's an idea, and it's an idea that makes sense. But what's also true is that ethics or virtue or morality, when I say morality, I mean that which makes complete sense as wholesome, as proper, kind, correct. Meditation naturally opens this so that there's no question about what to do sometimes in the face of violence, let's say. There's no question of what to do in the face of prejudice, of aggression, unkindness. Something spontaneous rises up and out. And ethics or virtue is part of the naturalness of our being. So as distractibility, this is another thing that many human beings struggle with, is the distractibleness of the mind, the body, the emotions. As this falls away through awakening and kinship and community, even just a little bit in our hours together, what begins to become clear is that what's actually falling away is fear and confusion. So what is confused? The person or mind that thinks or believes he or she is going to arrive at a better place through meditation or through being pious or through some practice, when in fact all that's actually happening is true meditation, when true meditation's occurring, all that's actually happening is the possibility that the longing or seeking or avoiding anything stops. And it can only stop when it's seen that there actually is no one who can long or seek. And then you, so to speak, helplessly fall into this question, into this region, into this realm. As awakening takes hold, it's free fall. Even amidst the free fall, the apparent trouble or stuckness may still arise. And humans are essentially struggling because of five distinct conditions. In Sanskrit, they're called kleshas. In the Buddhist Pali language, they're called kilesa, klesha and kilesa. And they're a little bit different, so watch how this comes out, those of you who know the traditional kileshas or defilements that they're taught in Buddhism? Kleshas, first one, is ignorance, not knowing the true nature of reality. Number two, grasping and attaching to that which is ephemeral, impermanent, and illusory. Number three, recoiling and being afraid of that which is transient and impermanent. Number four, identification with ego or personality. And number five, clinging to life, which conditions fear of death. Let's take apart the ignorance. Ignorance manifests actively through ignoring the truth, ignoring things as they really are, believing that matter is the ultimate or only real substance. That's one kind. Not understanding that concepts are not reality. And even if those concepts refer to ultimate reality or God or whatever, they're still concepts. And then also the ignorance of not seeing that all states, thoughts, feelings, conditions are transient and ephemeral. The tendency to ignore these things, yeah, is the first blockage, difficulty, or condition for suffering. Once the ignoring tendency is mobilized, because it's the root, then two more tendencies sprout up. Grasping and attaching to experiences as one, or recoiling, being afraid or aversive to experiences, and even recoiling from emptiness or absence of matter or form, which is part of what happens as awakening takes place, is that which seems solid, that which seems fixed, that which seems static starts to open up, and emptiness in various forms starts to appear. There can be fear or aversion or recoiling from that emptiness. One's actually feeling afraid to discover that one is nobody. So it's strange in a way, because we have no problem in most cases falling sound asleep and being nobody. But if it happens while we're consciously sitting on a meditation cushion, God forbid, how dare I dissolve? I had a panic attack once when this body started to dissolve, and I ran out of the room and wasn't even conscious of moving, and I ended up in a corner going, ooh, I freaked out. It's a fun moment. A little painful. Emptiness will and must come as the insights into the reality open. Because what we're doing is we're penetrating into matter, this matter. And through penetrating into this matter, we're finding out what really matters, both within the matter and beyond the matter. And then we have the fourth, klesha, identification with ego or identification with being a person or personality. And then point out here now, this is not about having an ego or personality, because we all have that, but rather identifying with this personality or ego in such a way to contract and separate from everything else through opinions of oneself, positive or negative, views and ideas about oneself or the world, and fundamentally identifying with the sense of I or me. And this conditions fear of death, which is the fifth. Clinging to life, holding to experiences, conditions fear of death. Desire for bodily, cognitive, or emotional continuity. Fear of the pending dissolution that one knows can come at any time. Any time. One knows this intuitively. Children know this. before school starts, intuitively. And this is intuitively true. This dissolution of body, mental, emotional formation in the nature of reality, in the true nature of reality, dissolution of this occurs. The first four kleshas, ignorance, grasping, recoiling, and ego identification, help to strengthen and condition the fifth, fear of death, an awakening to true reality that you are not essentially a person or body, but you are rather the eternal ever witnessing presence. That's the liberation we're born to realize. That is our birthright. We're all going, so to speak, to the same place. Or as Rumi says, we're all going through the same gate. So what is this competition then before we go? And that place is the realization that you are the infinite pretending to be a separate person and body. And so fascinating, I would add, it is that through experiencing this so-called separate person and body fully, that the realization that you are essentially not a separate person flowers. That's what it means to, in a way, the Christian tradition has this, the born-again experience, but to be embodied, right, to fully witness this, to fully open to this, brings naturally the realization that you're not this. And how can you realize you're not something that you haven't seen yet? Right? So if you don't know your knees, then it's potential that your knees hold this idea that they are you. I mean, you know what I mean. I'm playing with it here. It's thought. As the first klesha, ignorance fades away. And how does that happen? It happens through awakening. It happens through the company of those who care about the same kind of things you do. It happens through the silence. It happens through the meditation. It happens in the community of truth, like-minded friends. And it's precious. And it's still fairly rare on planet Earth, if you really consider the multitudes of us, the 6.5 billion or so. I do. I think about all of us. But as this first klesha fades, the other four are naturally reduced. And as the ignorance fades, then the tendency to grasp or to recoil or to identify with ego or to fear death naturally thins out. Quite direct. And so meditation, as it's being suggested here, has the power potential to reveal that what is happening is simply nothing appearing as everything. And so again, in the Zen tradition, Wu Men, 12th century Zen master, put it so clearly. He said, or wrote, "One instant is eternity. Eternity is now. When you see through this one instant, you see through the one who sees." On his coattails, some considered William Blake insane. The English writer, poet, I personally consider him awake. He wrote, or spoke, "He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Is that the words of a madman? Or are those the words of awakeningness? Holding to any state, joy or otherwise, is binding. All states by nature come and go. They pass through the sky of awareness. No one owns them. And yet, they contribute to the many colors and tones of life. And for this, we can be deeply grateful. If we are holding to some idea of awakening that's transcendent of these tones and flavors of the states, the joys, the sadnesses, the sorrows, all of that, if we're holding to some idea that awakening removes us from all of that, I would say we're chasing a carrot in the sky. We're missing something very precious. The dawning or sunrise of eternity comes through what I've been describing as seeing through. Seeing through means witnessing without interfering at all. In this scene, it's not about the content of what is being seen through, but it's about seeing through the idea that there is a present moment. The idea of the present moment is a concept or a thought. Again, please, will anyone show me where is the present moment? This is a very subtle trance called the present moment. The idea of the present moment is the concept or a thought, as much as past or future are concepts. Again, someone show me, where's the past, where's the future? Many of us have heard, or we believe, the future or past arises in the present moment. We have an idea that there's a present moment that past or future happen in. Wu Men in saying, seeing through this instant. This means seeing through the concept of time. The instant is a measurement of time. And as this opens, all there is what is happening, as it is, without any qualifying. What is happening, as it is what we call the present moment. This is happening in the present moment. That's time added on to what is naturally happening, spontaneously unfolding, without qualification. In the Upanishads, it said, not that which the eye sees, but that whereby the eyes can see. Know this, and this alone, to be Brahman the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that which the ears hear, that's the object, the content. Not that which the ears hear, but that whereby the ears can hear. Know this and this alone to be Brahman the eternal, not what people here adore. Not that which the mind thinks, but that whereby the mind can think. Know this and this alone to be Brahman the eternal, not what people here adore. Bewilderment or confusion would suggest that this sense of not what people here adore means shun the senses, shun the world. It's not what it's saying. It's simply saying there is this possibility of not fixating upon what the eyes see, but realize oneself as the intelligence that allows the eyes to see. And we can go straight to the historical Buddha in one of his most, for me, favorite teachings, when he said to the very ardent and earnest seeker who wanted the teachings and wanted them now, the Buddha was in arms round. You don't generally interrupt, but this guy was in a hurry, he'd come a long distance. He walked up and he said, give me the teachings now. You could die, I could die any second, give me the teachings now. The Buddha said, hang on. In those days, if there was a word for dude, he might have said it. Hang on, dude. I'm eating. Come over to the meditation center and I'll give you the teachings. The guy said, no. You could die, I could die any moment. Give me the teachings now. He said, okay, listen carefully. Listen carefully, he said. He got the man's attention. In the seeing, there is just what is seen. In the hearing, there is just what is heard. In the sense, that means taste, touch, smell, there is just what is sensed. In the thought, there's just the thought. That is the same teaching as the Upanishads. Bless you. There's an appearance that there's someone who's seeing. Someone who's looking through the eyes. Hearing through the ears, sensing through the tongue and taste and feeling through the body. There's an appearance that there's someone behind this. Thinking through the mind. Someone who's going to see through. Someone who's going to see through. And again, back to Wu Men. When you see through this one instant, you see through the one who sees. This means seeing through the idea that there is someone who is seeing. Seeing not only witnesses without interfering, but seeing through the idea that there is a present moment that someone can be present in. You can call life, things, experiences, whatever you want. Describe or interpret for whatever reason. But seeing through ends the need to know. It ends the need to understand, describe, and therefore to seek. And the only way that seeking can end is when it's seen that there is actually never anyone who can seek. All there is an appearance of seeking, but never anyone behind that energy that is going to find anything. At first, it's a big disappointment to the seeker. He, she doesn't want to quit, in some cases. And then, ultimately, it's a huge relief. Finally, if you want to go back to my dear sister, finally, after all of it, I get to be me, just as I am. We only seek because of the sense of separation. The sense of separation is an illusion. It's false. When you're close with another person and you're talking or touching or sharing, the sense of separation, just in the common exchange, one can feel it thinning. Human beings making love with other human beings, it doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes it happens that the sense of separation just falls away. Why did the French call it the petite ma? Ma means death, the small death. And it's very interesting that some people get attached to this small death called the orgasm. and they want it again and again and again. I want to die over and over and over in your arms. It becomes an addiction in some cases. So awakening then, awakening is the end of seeking, because there's a falling away of the dream of separation. Awakening is the radical discovery that there isn't anyone who is going to get anything, and there isn't anything to get. The mind's idea of awakening is getting something. Now, this is the mind's idea, I'm going to get something. What awakening actually is that idea that you're going to get something begins to crumble and fall away. That's awakening. And there's an apparent loss. But all that's lost is the idea that there's something to gain. So I'd like to close again with a poem. This poem is called No Path. There is no path that goes all the way. Hunsen. Not that it stops us looking for the full continuation. The one line in the poem we can start and follow straight to the end. The fixed belief we can hold facing a stranger that saves us the trouble of a real conversation. But one day, you are not just imagining an empty chair where your loved one sat. You are not just telling a story where the bridge is down and there's nowhere to cross. You are not just trying to pray to a God you imagined would keep you safe. No, you come to the place where nothing you've done will impress, and nothing you can promise will avert the silent confrontation. The place where your body already seems to know the way, having kept to the last its own secret reconnaissance. But still, there is no path that goes all the way. One conversation leads to another, one breath to the next, until there's no breath at all. Just the inevitable final release of the burden. And then, wouldn't your life have to start all over again for you to know even a little of who you had been? May all beings open into the teaching beyond becoming. May all beings be liberated from the burden of attachment to path. May all beings abide now in an ethos of love and compassion. And we can just sit for a few minutes together, please.